I'm very interested in knowing your thoughts you would share about how to let go of the sense of self.
We let go of the self.
The conceit, I am being, thinking I'm being something.
It is not very easy to let go of self, ego, or I consciousness, because it is so deeply rooted in our mind. When we see the truth very clearly, then we begin to find how important it is to let go of I. I is very interesting concept. As soon as we are conceived, when we are born, at least let us begin from there, as soon as we are born, the greed is born. And along with greed, ignorance is born. Now greed and ignorance have existed in samsara for very, very, very long time, and therefore as soon as greed meets ignorance, greed recognizes ignorance, and ignorance recognizes the greed. And since they have been in samsara very long, they are already matured. And they marry. Greed and ignorance marry right there. They don't wait to date. Because they are matured at the very moment. We are born with an ignorance, a very matured greed, matured ignorance are born. And they immediately fall in love with each other. And they are so matured, their love is so strong, the moment the greed and ignorance marry, greed gives birth to a baby. The child of greed and ignorance is called I. This I has no gender. That gives more confusion to greed and ignorance. This I that is born as a progeny of greed and ignorance can easily camouflage depending on where greed and ignorance live. So when this I at birth does not have a gender, but when it is born in a baby girl, then the I say I am a girl. When I is born in the baby boy, it says that I am a boy. But I itself doesn't have a gender. But the I is supported by greed and ignorance. Greed and ignorance keeps nourishing, supporting, maintaining, upholding, protecting I. Just imagine the moment we get rid of our greed, I disappears. The moment we get rid of our ignorance, I disappears. Both greed and ignorance never want to go away. Greed and ignorance want to go away because they have an attachment to this I. I doesn't want to go away, cannot go away because greed and ignorance support it. So occasionally greed gets tired of supporting I. So greed and ignorance have their own counselors. So when greed gets tired of this genderless I, greed goes to seek some help and some counseling from its counselor. They are the counselor of this greed and ignorance. Counselor of greed is called the whole counselors of greed and ignorance are called affection, love, desire, wanting, jealousy, fear, anger, confusion, and you know, becoming famous and this and that. These are the counselors of greed and ignorance. Whenever the greed and ignorance go and ask them some advice, they all would say, "You are doing fine. Keep supporting your I. Don't try to get rid of it." But the greed and ignorance find it very difficult because this I is so full of ego. And I would not listen either to greed or ignorance, the parents of I. So you can see the complexity of how I gets into. That is why getting rid of I is difficult, because it is nourished, supported by greed and ignorance. So the remedy is, the way to get rid of it is to get rid of not the I itself, but that which supports I, that is ignorance and craving or greed. You know, in the dependent origination, Buddha said, Buddha did not ask us to get rid of I. He said in the dependent origination, when ignorance is eliminated, then consciousness, mentality, materiality, sixfold base, contact, feeling, craving, clinging, grasping, becoming, birth, decay, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair disappear. What we have to do to get rid of all of them, to make them disappear, is to get rid of our ignorance. In the description of the Four Noble Truths, he said that when craving, in the first sermon he said that when the craving is eliminated, the entire mass of suffering will be eliminated. So in these two different discourses he gave two different advices. In one place he said you get rid of ignorance, in the other place he said you get rid of greed. He did not say we must get rid of I. Why he didn't say that? Because once you get rid of ignorance, you get rid of your craving. Because craving and ignorance are partners of this company. And when one disappears, other disappears. So we have to work around it instead of trying to get rid of I directly. We have to work around it. So, we have to let go of our clinging and craving in order to get rid of I. So that is what we do in our meditation practice. In the entire Noble Eightfold Path, we try to get rid of our Noble Eightfold Path. We practice to first to understand this. Understand this whole mass of suffering is caused by clinging and craving. And therefore, we learn, first we must learn from our own experience how craving causes our pain and suffering. So when we take, for instance, we understand this nature, and then we take a positive step. That positive step is the practice of mindfulness, meditation. How mindfulness meditation helps us to let go of things is when we pay total mindful attention to anything that we experience, anything in our life, we see something inevitable happening. That is, every tiny little thing we notice is impermanent. When something is impermanent, it is futile, meaningless for the mind or for us to hold on to it. It is sort of a losing battle. It is just like, you know, trying to, when we are really deeply mindful, and in that deep mindful state of mind, with a very good concentration, when we pay attention to our experiences, we definitely see that the mind cannot hold on to anything that we experience, because it is impermanent. It always slips away, disappears. Trying to hold on to anything we experience is like trying to balance a mustard seed on the moving, on the tip of a moving needle. Because things are changing so quickly, so fast, no matter how strong, powerful our mind is, how quick the mind is, then mind cannot fix or hold on to anything that we experience. Of course, this is a very deep, subtle level of understanding of impermanence. Once you understand that, then you realize what is there to hold on to. Only at that level you see that there is no I, no self. The notion of I and self is a very strong, very powerful concept. I also compare this to it's a very vivid simile I used to illustrate this. I say, what do you call the name on and on with I in the middle? On, I, and on. What is it? Anil. Isn't it? Onion from outside looks like a bubble, bulb. You peel it off, peeling layer after layer and layer. But inside there is no core, no heart. Similarly, we try to find the I in this ongoing process. Our existence is a process that's going on and on and on and on with I in the middle. We try to hold on to this I, and in the attempt we keep going on and on and on. It is a real confused, deluded concept, but it is so strong that we cannot let go of it. And it is because of this I we keep going on and on and on in samsara. Clinging to I is the force, the strength that perpetuates, that makes us go on and on and on. The moment we realize that things are impermanent, not as a theory, but from our experience we realize that everything we experience, we must see that with our eye of wisdom. That moment we begin to loosen up. That moment we begin to let go of our clinging. Since we cannot cling to anything, virtually it is impossible, because the moment we try to cling to something, it is no longer there. Because the very nature of impermanence disappears. And we gain this insight when we practice meditation. We must see this insight, we must see this reality. So where can we see this reality? This non-existence of self, where can we see? And where do we, what do we become mindful of to see this non-existence of self? We look with our mental eye, we look at ourselves, look at our body, feelings, perceptions, thoughts and consciousness. All these five together are called our domain, our field, our scope, our subject of mindfulness. The notion of I also exists in this, what we call five aggregates. Notion of I does not exist somewhere else. We think either the body is I, or I has a body, or body is in the I, or I is in the body, or body is separate from the I. You know, it is very interesting, we say, my body. Just mindfully watch this particular statement. Just mindfully look at this statement. This phrase, my body. When we say my body, who says my? It's worse, is even worse is this. My mind. We say my mind. When we say my mind, what is it that says my? So we mindfully, we look at this kind of statement analytically, mindfully. Look at this kind of statements and keep asking the question. Of course, behind all this, sometimes people think because of this long sort of strong conditioning, normally people tend to think there is an entity within ourselves that says my body, or that says my mind, or my feeling, my perceptions, my thought, let alone my chair, my table, my house and outside and so forth. But within this mind and body, people tend to think that there is an entity which always identifies things and say, this is my such and such. When we mindfully look at the body, feeling, perception, thought and consciousness, we don't see such entity. Because everything incessantly is changing. The moment we realize this truth, that moment our notion of I will be shattered, broken into pieces, disappears. That means seeing impermanence. To answer the question briefly, I must say, seeing impermanence of all our aggregates, we will be able to get rid of the notion of self. Seeing impermanence is not easy because of the rapidity of experience. Because of the perception of solidity, what is called in Pali Ghana Sanya, perception of compactness, unity, solidity, concept. And that concept disappears when we see impermanence. In the discourse on selflessness, which is called Anatta Lakkhana Sutta, Buddha mentioned something very fundamental that not too many people, not even one before him, said so boldly that there is no self. And his first statement of the of this discourse on selflessness, very first opening statement was, because form is not self, rupam vikre anatta, straight away, form is not self. And he went on elaborating the meaning of the statement. He said, form is not self. If the form were self, then this form will not fall into afflictions. It will not fall sick. And self, if there is self, self should be able to control this form and make it remain without falling sick. Since there is no self, Buddha said, the form is subject to sickness, afflictions. Then he said, that which is impermanent, is it satisfactory or unsatisfactory? He asked. Then the answer he gave himself, the bhikkhu gave the answer, said that it is impermanent, Venerable Sir. And he said, that it is impermanent, it is satisfactory or unsatisfactory? It is unsatisfactory, Venerable Sir. If it is unsatisfactory, impermanent, is it correct to consider that this is mine, this is myself, this I am? The answer is no. That means that which is impermanent, unsatisfactory, is necessarily selfless. So this is what we see on feelings, perception, thought, consciousness. We can see this only when we deepen our insight into the reality of impermanence of all of them. That is the way. But without seeing impermanence of these five aggregates, you cannot get rid of self. It is so difficult question, difficult notion, that there are discourses like Brahma Jala Sutta, Jiganikaya, first discourse, where he analyzes the self notion into 62 different views. I mean, these are 62 different views that existed in his time. All these views based on self, divided into permanent self and temporary self, or nihilism and eternalism. And there is another discourse which also is more, very profound, and after delivering the discourse, the audience, that was the only discourse in the entire teachings of the Buddha, by listening to which the audience were displeased. At the end of all other suttas, the audience were very, they applauded, they said, this is excellent, to this discourse says, Abhikkhantam bhogavatam, Abhikkhantam bhogavatam, Nikkhujitam avukhujaya, Patichannam yuvareya, Maggasa, Murnangachike, Andhakareva, Tela Padyotam, Dhare, Chakumani, Rupani, Bhaktinti, so forth. That is, the sermon is excellent, Venerable Sir. It is marvelous. It's just like turning pot that is turned upside down, turning upside up for people to see what is inside. It is just like lighting a lamp to see objects in the dark room. It is just like showing the path to someone who is bewildered in a desert, and so forth. They had a lot of praise for the sermons, at the end of the sermons, every sermon, except this one. When he delivered this sermon, there were 500 very highly educated, learned monks. They all were disappointed, displeased. Anabhinandunti, the sutta ends saying Anabhinandunti. Other suttas end with Abhinandunti. Abhinanda means pleased, Anabhinanda means displeased. What is the discourse? Discourse is called Root of All Existence. The first sermon, first discourse in the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle and saying. It dealt with, Buddha dealt with the self in a very subtle way. In order to shatter the ego of these 500 monks, who came from Brahmin families, very learned people, and because of their education in Vedic literature, they were very proud, full of ego. So Buddha wanted to shatter their ego by delivering this sermon. But they were so egotistic, they were very much disappointed. It is said that they were disappointed because they did not understand the sermon. Some say they were disappointed because the sermon was so simple. But truth is that they were so, in either case, whether they are understood the sermon and disappointed, or they understood too well and disappointed. They understood, if they understood it too well and disappointed, because their attachment to self was so strong that they were disappointed with themselves. How to get rid of this self, which we uphold so dearly, so long, traditionally. This is our main, you know, support in life. How can we get to it? Because of the attachment to self, they could not be happy. If they did not understand and disappointed, we can understand that it is boring. Because Buddha dealt with 28 categories to point out how subtle, deep, all pervasive this notion of self is. So notion of self, of course, is not that easy to grasp and especially to get rid of. But Buddha always made things workable by giving us a tool to work with. When we use that tool, then any unsolvable problem can be solved. That tool is threefold tool. I mean, it has three functions. And these three functions must work together. Three factors. They are understanding, mindfulness, and effort. These we find in the Noble Eightfold Path. These three factors are called three cardinal factors of the Noble Eightfold Path. So we put this in one sentence. That is, we must make mindful effort to understand. Or we understand with mindful effort. Without understanding this very notion, we cannot get rid of it. We cannot get rid of it without making effort. We cannot get rid of it without mindfulness. So all these three cardinal factors, the Noble Eightfold Path, work quite effectively to get rid of this notion of self. So we have to make effort to be mindful. We have to make effort to understand what we understand is impermanent, unsatisfactoriness and selflessness. What we see with mindfulness also is impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and selflessness. What we do with effort is to keep the mind from becoming attached to the notion, to anything. So this is the tool that Buddha strongly recommended us to use to chip off the notion of self. There is a stone in Sanskrit book called Panchatantra. That story, I like to use that story to illustrate this notion of self, but the story is not related to the notion of self in any way. But I use it because it gives very good image. Story is of a fox. The fox was very hungry and he was looking for food and he was roaming in the jungle, and he heard a big sound, big noise, big sound of a he thought it was an animal. So he walked towards that direction where the sound came. Then as he approached the sound was louder. Then he saw a huge object. He thought that it was a very big, fat animal with a lot of flesh in it, in him. What he saw there was a huge drum that was left behind. There was a battle between two armies, and one army ran away, leaving the drum they brought for the battlefield. And when the wind blew, a tree branch, a branch of a tree, hit the eye of the drum, and it made noise. So the fox thought this was an animal, and he was with tremendous effort, he managed to beat into the eye of the drum. As he beat into it, he smelled the leather, dry leather. Then he thought this must be real animal, the flesh must be inside. So he kept on, biting, finally he managed to drill a hole in it, and found inside was empty. he said, Purvameva maya jnatam, purnameda dhimedasam, anupravishya vijnatam, yava charmata daruca. That means he said that I thought before that this was full of flesh and blood, But when I broke into it, I found inside just a block of wood and a dry piece of leather. No flesh and blood. I think of this story, this boxer's statement, then I think of the notion of self. The notion of self is very much like this fox's notion of flesh and blood and the animal. When you mindfully analyze the notion of self, you will be surprised that there's none inside, no self. But it is extremely difficult for somebody to get rid of it without letting go of the attachment to impermanent things. So we have to see the impermanence exactly as it is, and then we must learn to learn not to attach to the impermanence, to see the selflessness. When we see impermanence, we see selflessness, then we will be able to get rid of the notion of selflessness. So this is the technique we have to be mindful, we have to make effort, we have to practice mindfulness, we have to see impermanence, we have to train the mind not to cling to the impermanent things. Then we do all this self-will vanish. It's not very simple, straightforward way. Any other question?
Would you care to say a little bit about the importance of sila as a foundation for concentration and other things?
I think you probably might have heard many times sila, morality is the foundation of happiness, foundation of concentration, foundation of liberation of life. When we observe sila, in order to make it meaningful and beneficial, effective, we must do it with understanding. Understand why we observe or practice sila. Not as a ritual. When we say, for instance, even the precept, if we repeat them as a ritual every day, of course, even if we repeat them with understanding, it has a meaning. It is effective. If we repeat them as a ritual, it will not bring any meaning, any result. So the precepts are the things that we voluntarily, with understanding, accept to observe in order to strengthen our confidence, practice, because when we practice sila, anytime we try to meditate, we would not have restlessness and worry, one of the hindrances. We become, we worry about things that we did wrongly, something unethical, immoral. Then we worry about their repercussions. And when we worry, we become restless. So that is a hindrance to gaining concentration. And therefore, moral observances would make our mind calm, settled, relaxed, confident. We would not worry about anything because we did things rightly, ethically, morally. Then mind would not be full of restlessness. We gain concentration. Therefore, that is a very direct result of observing sila, so that we can avoid restlessness and worry. We recite at the end of every time we give the precept, silena sugatin yanti, silena bhoga sampada, silena nibbutin yanti. These three statements. Silena sugatin yanti, one goes to a happy state of life, existence, by morality. Silena bhoga sampada, one becomes rich and silena nibbuti yanti, one attains enlightenment by observing sila. How does that work? How does one go to a happy state of existence through the practice of morality? That is because when one keeps doing right thing, correct thing, wholesome thing, ethical, moral thing, just thing with honesty and sincerity, that becomes the habit of that person's life. Whatever we habitually do, repeatedly, every day, that becomes our the strongest mental state that makes the most powerful thought pattern, mindset, mind state. With that, we keep doing the same thing with more confidence, more strength, more joy, more happiness. We keep doing that seeing the result of wholesome things that we do. Even observing the precept every day, in Buddhist countries, you know, most of the time people do it as a ritual. But even if they do it as a ritual with meaning, with understanding, this becomes sort of a habitual repetition. And whenever you do something habitually, if you encounter a situation, the moral principle, moral precept or thought of morality you will remember. I should not do this. I have been repeating this over and over and over again. I should not do this. So that habitual repetition becomes a protective measure to guard against doing something wrong. So that becomes perpetual practice. So, every day when one wakes up, if one reflects on what he has done in the past, yesterday, then the person would feel a change. I would be very happy to reflect, to remember that yesterday I did quite well. Yesterday my life was very smooth. I did not say anything wrong. I did not do anything wrong. My thoughts, words, deeds were very good. Very moral, ethical, honest, sincere. With that feeling one starts the day's work. And take the precept again in the morning, and keep up the precept that whole day. Next day the person repeats, evening repeats, morning repeats. Every time the person repeats with understanding, the person gets more and more joyful, becomes happy, and when the person is going to die, at the death, last moment of one's life, this would become the last thought moment. This is called death proximate thought, or thought of dying thought. It's called chuti-chitta in Pali. And that also is called kamma nimitta, the sign of kamma. Kamma is the thing that you have done repeatedly, again and again, intentionally. So this becomes a wholesome practice. In morality itself becomes a wholesome kamma. And that becomes the last thought moment when you die. And that last thought, according to that last thought moment, you will rebirth. So that is why it is said, silena sugatin yanti. By morality, you go to wholesome state of existence. Go to heaven. So your next birth would be in heaven. Why? You live the heavenly life now by practicing morality. And also by practicing morality, the moment you try to meditate, you gain concentration very quickly. Why? Because there is no remorse, regret in your mind, no worry, no restlessness. You gain concentration. When you gain concentration, your hindrances are all suppressed. Mind remains concentration is a wholesome one-pointedness of mind. The moral foundation is an additional support for you to gain wholesome one-pointedness of mind. So with the wholesome one-pointedness of mind, with the concentration, you keep practicing your meditation, and you even would be able to see, you practice with concentration, you practice vipassana, of course. Mindfulness, you go to practice with concentration. When you practice mindfulness with concentration, then you will see impermanence more clearly, because our attention is focused on our experiences with concentration. We focus our attention on our experiences with concentration. Then we will see impermanence more clearly. So that concentration is absolutely necessary to practice, even practice vipassana, to see impermanence in a deepest level, in a subatomic molecular level. In order to get rid of our notion of self. So, that way, when we see impermanence, unsatisfactoriness and selflessness in that level, at that level, we attain the stages of enlightenment and attain Nibbana. That is why it is said, Silena Nibbutin Yanti. How can one become rich with morality, bhoga sampada? The sampada is achievement. There are various kind of sampadas. Jhāga sampadā, sīla sampadā, bhoga sampadā, that means achievement. When one practice morality, one gains confidence as well as good friends, trust. People trust you when you are moral, ethical. I tell you a very simple story. I think I have mentioned it in one of my books. A businessman, very successful businessman, found another businessman. And this is a true story, not taken from a book, the story that I know well. So one businessman invited the other businessman for a lunch. So they went to a restaurant. When they sat at the dinner table, they ordered beer. So there were two beer mugs in front of them on the table. A bee came and sat on the rim of the mug, of beer mug. So one businessman, the bee sat on the beer mug of one businessman. So he had little stick with him. So when the bee sat on the rim of the mug of beer, this man with the stick pushed the bee into the mug. So this bee, with great struggle, came out of beer and sat on the rim. This man pushed him down again into beer. Again the bee came out. Again this man pushed him in. Again he came out. Again he pushed him in. Until the beer drowned, he went on pushing him into the beer mug. Other businessman was watching it. And he thought, he was very upset, very disappointed. And he went home and he cancelled the business deal with this man. And he told his wife, "Dear, this is a very cruel man. He can do anything to make money. His mentality is very vicious, very mean." So he told her the story. So she told us. That's how ethical he was, how unethical the other man was. And the other man lost the business deal. This man continued to become prosperous. The one who was upset seeing this man pushing the bee into the beer. So it seems to be a very simple incident, but that is big enough for a thinking person to understand how immoral the other person is. So when we observe, when we do business, we have to maintain ethics, moral, in order to win the confidence. To, you know, I saw a couple of, three people started the computer shop in our area. Each person, when they sold computers, they borrowed a lot of money to open the computer shop, to rent a house and rent a building and buy the merchandise and so forth and so on. Each person, instead of putting the money into the drawer, they pocketed the money. The bank account was empty. Three of them stole the money secretly. So eventually, they were caught. They could not pay the mortgage, what you call the loan, and they lost the business. This is a very true story that I know myself. So, if they observe the very simple principle, very common sense, moral, they would have not lost their business. So, this is why it is said in this life, in the material world, even in the material world, to be successful honestly, one has to be moral, ethical. Of course, in immoral and unethical ways also some people become prosperous. But with a lot of mental suffering, with pain, remorse, worries. Eventually they end up with a lot of ill health because their motive is something. So, when we look at it from any angle, we can see the moral ethical practice is a foundation of success in spiritual life as well as in material life and for the attainment of enlightenment. That is the foundation. That is why it is said in Saṅyutta Nikāya, sīle patikkāya narosa kannu cittaṁ paññaṁ ca bhāve ātāpi nipako bhikkhu so imaṁ vijate yataṁ. The Visuddhi Magga, whole Visuddhi Magga is based on three aspects of sīla, samādhi, paññaṁ. And in the Buddha's teaching itself, the entire teaching is divided into these three categories. Sila, Samadhi, Panya. Because Buddha knew the strength, benefit and power